The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network. Stephanie, we're on air.
Good evening and welcome to the Race Treaty Show on Black Talk Radio Network. My name is Stephanie Franklin and I am the co-chair of the Ubuntu Council, a council of human rights activists who are honoring and celebrating the International Decade for People of African Descent, and chair of the Baltimore Coalition for the United Nations Working Group of Experts on People of African Descent, when they made their visit to the United States the 19th through the 29th of January of this year. I am your guest host this evening, and as always, I would like to open by thanking Robin Jerome Benton, creator of the show, Scotty Reed, the producer, and Onaji Muid for inviting me to guest host this evening. As all of you listeners know, the Race Treaty Show gives the community a voice to educate the public about issues pertaining to African peoples and human rights in honor of the International Decade for People of African Descent. Tonight's show is in celebration of Women's History Month, which is a month that's been designated for women's history in the U.S. But this month also has other celebratory days. March 1st was the International Women of Color Day, and March 8th, Tuesday, is International Women's Day. So tonight's show is in celebration of all three of these days and this month. So tonight we will engage in conversation with three dynamic women to discuss women descendants of Africans enslaved in the U.S., healers, culture bearers, and women of resistance. Tonight's panel will discuss the history of the use of herbal medicine by women descendants of Africans enslaved in the U.S., who you will hear me refer to as deist women, its influence on herbal medicinal practice today, and its exclusion from mainstream herbal and alternative medicinal educational curricula and practice. Please welcome my three guests. First, I'd like to introduce Karen L. Culpepper, who is a clinical herbalist, licensed massage therapist, and the founder of Embracing Rhythm, a clinical practice located in Fort Washington, Maryland, dedicated to rhythmic living and empowering people to make informed decisions about their body. Our next guest will be Stephanie McKee. Ms. McKee is a clinical herbalist with a particular interest in African diasporic botanical and medicine practices in the Americas. She resides in Detroit, Michigan, and teaches classes and workshops on herbal medicine, engages urban farmers to incorporate growing medicinal herbs into the narrative of food security, and managed a free herb clinic that provides free herbal medicine consultations to Westside residents. And our final panelist is Rochelle Ikioma Walker, who is a registered nurse and a graduate of ECPI University, where she earned a Bachelor of Science in Nursing. She is a traveling registered nurse and a spiritual counselor. Ikioma's holistic approach to healing encompasses conventional and alternative methods used to treat the whole person, physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual, rather than simply managing disease. So, ladies, welcome to the show. Before we get started with questions this evening, I want to talk about a little bit on why I chose this topic tonight. So I selected this topic because it is something that a very small population knows about. It is a topic that speaks to the dynamism, wisdom, and spiritual genius of African people. Given our history of enslavement and colonization, we and the world have been taught that African peoples have had very little to add to the development and evolution of this planet, seeing us only as enslaved, colonized beings incapable of intellectual depth, critical thought, or backward superstitions. We have been ridiculed, fooled, defrauded, and robbed of our contributions and the social, political, economic, scientific, and spiritual dimensions of this world. Even in the most torturous, inhumane, degrading positions as enslaved or colonized humans, nothing could stop our genius because we are a spiritual people that are guided by the knowingness and the depths of our bones. The beauty of our Africanity is evident in the conversation we will have tonight as we learn about the resilience and resistance and sheer genius of women descendants of Africans enslaved in the U.S. So having said all of that, I want to start with you, Karen. And I want to ask you about Embracing Rhythm. I find that to be a very interesting name. And as an African woman, why that name? Why Embracing Rhythm?
Well, first, thanks for having me today, this evening. And so, Embracing Rhythm, it came to me as a name as a way to really honor my lineages as well as my upbringing. My father was raised in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. My paternal grandmother grew up in Paulus Island in South Carolina, and my mother is Chinese. So I was actually born in Taiwan, and my parents moved here to the States. And so I always grew up in this multi-generational, multicultural gumbo of teachings, as I call it. And so we had a huge garden when I was growing up, and that's how I learned about food and seasonal living and rhythm and gender roles in my family. And so the men worked the land and grew the food, and the women, specifically my grandmother, every day prepared food and fed three households. And so as a child, my brother and I, we were in charge of tending to the garden. We had to water germinated seeds and make sure they were in at night. We would harvest vegetables for dinner. And then in the fall, my grandmother would make like hot peppers and pickled vegetables. And in the wintertime, we had like nasty bitter melons to stay healthy throughout the seasons. And so that's how I came up with the name Embracing Rhythm, just as a way to honor not only seasonal rhythms, but incorporate daily rituals, weekly rituals, monthly rhythms into daily living.
So, I asked you that question because, again, I do think it's a very interesting name. And rhythm, too, is something that is known to be something that actually lives in the soul of African people in particular. Mm-hmm. And so listening to you talk about that, honoring your two lineages, in addition to the rhythm of nature, the rhythm of the seasons, and how you use food as not only to nourish the body, but as a healing element in some fashion. I want to know, how does that coincide with the work that you do in the world?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, I just left an open house. I work out of a space in DC, Free Body Works, which is an integrative practice, you know, dedicated to creating a space of radical inclusion. And so one of the, or at least my little exercise this evening was all about spring. We made do-it-yourself herbal, like prepare your body for spring allergy tea bag. And I find as, and this is coming from a space of being a clinician, I find that people usually get stuck in a particular season for whatever reason. There are some seasons they absolutely love, and then there are other seasons they do not particularly care for. So it's interesting just to see how, you know, we dance with the season just as individuals as well. Rhythm is very near and just dear to my heart. It is I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but even the rhythm of just drumming is so moving. It's so spiritual and so moving for me. And I'm just getting off track. I apologize.
So now I want to bring into this conversation, Steph. And I'm going to call you Fee on this call. I want to ask Stephanie. So you heard Karen speak about rhythm and seasons and food and the nourishment. And you heard me talk about rhythm is something that is particularly known to be, it sits very strongly in the soul of African people. So I want you to tell us a little bit about who you are, Fee, and the work you do, and about a journey you took. I mean, it's probably been a couple of years ago, when you traveled with a group of friends throughout the Americas to connect with your rhythmic energy as it relates to your spirituality and particularly your work with herbal medicine. Can you share who you are and what you do, and begin to tell us a little bit about that journey?
Sure. Thank you for having me on the show. And I want to say hello to the other women on the show. Yes, absolutely. So let's see. So who am I? I have many different names. Mostly people know me as Fee. I am Urban Roots on Facebook, Stephanie McKee from my school world. I have a profound love for traveling and teaching people about herbal medicine. And so it's not a coincidence that I was able to combine those two, and you know, get to, as a result, have been able to learn more about herbalism in the Americas and in Africa as well. So, our road trip came about. I'm going to say first of all, it was a divinely inspired idea. Kioma and I, Rochelle Walker, was on the call. We've had this conversation over the years just about traveling and traveling differently and wanting to be with the people, see, you know, just travel from not a touristy kind of perspective, but to be in communities of people, see how they live. And that's typically when I travel, that's kind of how I'm blessed to be able to do it. I end up with a family somewhere living with them, and I sort of just get immersed into their world. So this was a conversation that had gone for a couple of years. I want to call it like an audio, just like a verbal vision board in a sense. We would talk about what we like to see and experience and what would be dope. And I think one day, I think after talking to you, Mecca, you had come back from your trip to Belize and how you shared how phenomenal it was and how beautiful it was. And that got us to thinking, huh, Belize. Ikioma had already been there and she wanted to see it in a different way. And so we started to formulate, we got the idea like, okay, this is where we're going, but we weren't sure how we were going to get there. We were looking at buses, we were looking at, you know, flying, and I was connected with an elder that I know in Baltimore that happens to own land in Belize. That was a retreat space for healing. So, you know, that's all up my alley. Because I also like to host retreats and all of that stuff. And his name is Baba Jabbar. We sat down with him and he just was like, oh, well, you know, I drive there. Like, out of the blue. He's like, you know, you can drive there. I've done it a couple times. And we were like, really? So that actually became the plan. We knew Belize was the destination. And so then we sort of, you know, it started to come together. It was very loose. We didn't have like anything super solid. We connected with another woman, Regine Romain, who's a photojournalist. And we each decided to make this an intentional journey to kind of look back at our past, to find what we, you know, to just find ourselves, to find our ancestors, see what we were doing. For me, I was going to focus on the world of herbalism, and Regine through photography, Rochelle through dance and midwifery. And so that became the structure for our journey. And we got on the road. We started in Maryland and ended in Belize, and we hit up a bunch of places along the way. And it was just so, when I say divinely inspired and just the ancestors were with us, we didn't have a straight plan etched in stone, but every place we went, somebody pointed us to the next place. And it just happened to be within what we were looking for. So, And you know, I don't know if you want me to go into all of that now, but
let me interrupt you for a moment. So basically, what I'm gathering is that not only was it divinely inspired, but you were looking for ancestral memory. Basically, you wanted to know. Absolutely. From an herbalist perspective that as you journey to Belize, you wanted to collect information concerning what we've done in terms of Afro-descendant folk medicine in this country. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, indeed. Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, the journey was called I Am African American Memory. Sort of with I Am. And, you know, the idea was that, you know, we could look to our past to you know, find ourselves and define our work. Because really, as we, you know, in our schooling, in my schooling particularly, I would sit in classes and we'd get, you know, all this other information about herbalism and other cultures and their involvement in herbalism, and we'd be taught about that, but nothing was said about what Black folks in America did with herbalism. And
so let me finish this statement, and then I want to pull Ikioma into the conversation.
Okay, or even, for that matter, the African herbalism. So,
okay.
Go ahead.
For you, that was what?
So for me, you know, I would sit in these classes and be like, okay, so Black folks just didn't exist, didn't have any healing. Like, what's going on here? I would always be left wanting more. As wonderful as the information was that we got, I never saw myself, my ancestry in any of the conversation and any of the learning. And it was a struggle for me to sit through school and go, you know, and hear that and see that.
Okay, so then let me pull Ikioma into this conversation. Ikioma, piggybacking on that, we know that you're a registered nurse, but you do a number of things. So I want to ask you, what was, you journeyed with Fee on this trip to Belize, as you all drove across the U.S. basically, down to Central America to Belize. Why was this journey important to you? And how does it feed your work today?
Okay. Well, first, thank you for allowing me to be on the show. And hello to the other sisters. I just wanted to say, number one, it was very passionate for me. Number one, I'm kind of like a third generation nurse in my family. My great grandmother was a midwife and nurse in South Carolina. And my grandmother's twin was also a nurse. And so I'm the nurse in my generation of my family. And so this is something that's more like a calling, you know? And I remember being a little girl sitting at my aunt's table. And even though she did a number of things, I remember women would come in her house and all the women would sit in the kitchen and they would ask her questions. She worked at the hospital, but she did, you know, it was like the free clinic of the neighborhood, you know, and it was just during conversation, you know, women would come in and talk. She also pressed hair. So that was, you know, another thing. So while women were waiting to get their hair done, they would have these conversations about how do you do this and what about this. And, you know, she would go in her pantry and pull out stuff, you know, and to give them. So it was, you know, I grew up where this was just kind of a part of the culture. You know, women sit in the kitchen and, you know, there's always somebody that knows how to help everybody. And so I started traveling as a nurse, as a travel nurse, and I actually started in home health. And so there's one thing, people go into the hospitals or to the doctor's clinic, when we go out in public, there's a certain mask. When you go into people's homes and their comfort zone, you get a lot more information. And I was finding that I was coming across a lot of elderly African-American women that would have very candid conversations with me about, you know, what they used to do and, you know, healing and, you know, and their health and that sort of thing. So,
and why was that so profound for you? Why was that so profound for you?
Well, because to piggyback off of what Stephanie was saying, these are not things that are taught in traditional school. You know, when you go to college for these professions, there's never discussion about what, you know, what people did in the African American community. And so this is not something that you're going to, well, they do have some books, but you have to do your own research. This is not a textbook that you're going to be given in a traditional educational setting. So, you know, I just happen to be privy to grow up in that type of environment and having conversations with other women. Not everybody has been privy to that. So, you know, I just found it just impressive. And it was like when I went behind closed doors and I would sit down at the table with these elder women, it was like they would just open up. They were like encyclopedias and they would just, you know, start telling me, you know, all kinds of things. And I was just, you know, just taken aback. And I share that information, and, you know, anytime I can, whenever the subject come up, especially with younger women. You know, the society now is just, everybody wants to just go straight to the doctor, you know, and don't question what the doctor says. And, you know, it's because we don't have our own connection. We don't trust our own instinct. We don't have people who have our best interest at heart when making medical or health decisions. So,
well, what you're raising is very critical. This information that you're raising is critical because what I hear you saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Ikioma, is that this information has been in our lineage as African people for many generations, that the knowledge has been there, but as Stephanie indicated, it's not taught in mainstream dominant school cultures, right? It's excluded. You said the same thing, and that you actually grew up around this information where this would be considered quote unquote folk medicine, where you're getting an encyclopedia, you said, of information about different herbs and how to treat different ailments and illnesses. And so having said that, I want to pull Karen into this conversation. Karen, we know that you have a master's in herbal medicine from what was formerly called Thai Sophia, which is now called the Maryland University of Integrative Health. And so having said that, I know you did a critical your master's thesis was on enslaved women in the U.S. and how they use cotton rhubarb as a form of resistance. Can you educate our listeners about cotton rhubarb and then how these women use it as a form of resistance?
Absolutely. So I am totally on. First, Fee and I, we were a year apart in school at Thai Sophia, and I share her sentiment. I did not see myself in the program. I think out of a 3-year program, we had maybe an hour and 15-minute lecture on herbal medicine and slaves out of our entire education. And so one of the requirements for graduation is to do a monograph. And so I went to the director and I said, I want to write about an herb that slave women used. Like that is my contribution, not only to the ancestors, but also to the school. And my instructor mentioned cotton rhubarb. So I said, huh, okay. And I quickly outgrew the school's library. There just were not a lot of resources about cotton rhubarb. And so cotton rhubarb is an emmenagogue, so that promotes menstrual flow. It is also an oxytocic herb, so that causes, like when women are in labor, oxytocin increases. So cotton rhubarb causes contractions, and cotton rhubarb was used as an abortifacient to terminate pregnancies. And so the horrors of slavery, period, the amount of suffering that our ancestors endured, there in Africa and here, from the Middle Passage to here in the United States. And I remember doing research and I was literally almost in tears. There were accounts of women who knew they were being stolen and separated from the land, and they would just gather dirt and swallow it just to stay and feel connected to their native land. And so we're talking cotton being a very labor-intensive crop. I was able to locate calendars from plantations. I mean, cotton was literally processed January through December. Human torturing, human suffering, millions of deaths, millions of human souls that suffered.
But these women used cotton rhubarb as an abortive.
As an abortifacient. And so it was a silent rebellion. It was a way for them to have some sort of say and control over their reproductive rights.
So not only their reproductive rights, what else was it? What else did them using cotton rhubarb show for you?
For me, perseverance and strength
And not only that, the knowledge, you know, I think there is, people come from a space as if there's no, like, slaves were incompetent and ignorant and all these things, like savages that needed to be disciplined, and that's not the case at all. And so I'll use the example, if right now, if we were all captured, we would all still have our gifting. We would all still have the tools that we use as an attorney and as herbalist and as a nurse. And so the fact that this knowledge, cotton was prevalent in Africa, cotton was prevalent in India as well. And so it was just transplanting, just using the knowledge that they had before here in the United States.
Okay, so, all right. So I want to bring Stephanie back into this conversation. And you heard Karen talk about cotton root bark, and it was a form, the enslaved women used it as a form of resistance in terms of control and domination over their own bodies. And also, curtailing their progeny from being born into enslavement. I mean, you know, this is huge, right? So on your journey, you mentioned several things, Stephanie. You talked about your mainstream education and how it felt when you were getting your master's in herbal medicine, on not having anything about African people or Afro-descendant people in the U.S. contributing to anything in terms of herbal medicine. But you also talked about your journey to belief. And so in your journey to belief, can you tell us what states in the U.S. you did visit? And on those visits, were you able to learn anything about any particular herbs that we use as African people to heal ourselves during that period?
Okay, yes. So the states we visited were, which we started in Maryland. And I want to just acknowledge some of the people that I connected with in Maryland before the journey. I used to live at a place called Eden Valley, and right next door was a farm, Bishop's Farm. And these, the folks that lived there had been farmers for several generations. And one of the elder there, Mr. Bishop, he would talk to me about making dandelion wine. outside of that, there wasn't too much more information available, readily available. This was a farm that was run by men, and so there wasn't a lot of information there. From Maryland, we ended up in North Carolina.
Were they Afro descendants?
Absolutely, yes. I'm sorry, I left that out. Mm-hmm. They were. And they had chickens and, you know, pear trees, and that there was some okra. They grew okra and another, you know, another kind of food. So we would go there and get our eggs from there. Fresh eggs, you know, right next door. It's great. We ended up, we drove down on through Virginia to North Carolina, and met with some people there, more Western herbalists, and kind of, you know, looked at some of the, we were in the mountains of North Carolina, and got to kind of imagine what it would be like to travel through there, harvesting herbs in the woods. Solomon seal was one of them. But again, you know, not a whole lot of information there, mm-hmm. not a lot of folks that we could like lean on to get information specifically from Black Americans. That wasn't there. South Carolina, we connected with the Gullah Geechee Nation. And that was a phenomenal occurrence. We went on a tour of the Gullah Islands. They spoke a little bit about herbalism, but because of how the Gullah Geechee folks have been exploited with that information, there have been white folks that have come before asking about
herbal medicine. They were very closed mouth about that. Like, and if you, and I think this speaks to the culture of South Carolina in general. Like, if you're not from there and you don't know, and they're not going to be open to share information with you. You see some of that repeated as I get down into Belize, and I'll share about that. But, we also visited Oyutunji Village, which is an African, centered religion camp down there, and it's a Yoruba based tradition, and so we got to talk to the people that ran that, and got to look at the shrines that they brought over, and that was also really beautiful. But you know, it wasn't anything that related, well, not even that it related particularly, but in terms of people having remedies on hand to share and what they remembered, not a whole lot of that. There was a woman on her way into Alabama. She was close to Alabama in Georgia. We went through to Valdosta, Georgia. We found this little place. It seemed like it was in the middle of nowhere, but she had like this artist kind of thing going on. And she was an elder, and we just stopped. We didn't know it was run by a black woman. And we just were like, oh, let's just check that out. And so we get out to check it out, and she had all of these, like, interesting things that she, I don't, you know, she used, like, scrap metal and mirrors and pictures, and she was just pulling all of this stuff together. And it caught our eye, and so we went in, and she was there, and we got to talk to her, and I asked her if she remembered being treated by her grandmother with herbs when she was younger, and she was like, I do. Yes, that's what we came up on, but she didn't have remedies that she could talk about specifically, but she did remember that, but it also wasn't something that she kept, you know, so that...
Okay. So let me interrupt here, because I want to pull Ikioma into this part of the conversation, because I want to ask her. You raised Fee that she does remember being treated from her grandmother with herbs, and we know that Ikioma is a registered nurse, and I want to flip the conversation. I want to change it a little bit, and I want to ask Ikioma, what is a doula? What is a midwife? And why are both or one of these positions so important in our community and our communal memory and history?
Okay. Hello?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's like a little delay. Well, first of all, doulas and midwives, they pretty much work together synergistically. Doulas usually provide more emotional and practical support for mothers during pregnancy, you know, like during the process of pregnancy, the birth, and, you know, postpartum care a little bit. And the midwife is basically what a lot of people or a lot of women now use the gynecologist for. It's basically the person for the delivery and the birth, and the person who, you know, manages the care of the mother during the pregnancy and the birth of the child. And they do work synergistically. Today, there are, you know, and depending on which state you are, there are a lot of states where home birth is illegal, and you can find few throughout the country, more so in the Midwest and in the West. They have birthing centers, you know, alternatives outside of the hospital. They're far and few between, I find, in the South, in certain parts of, you know, the East Coast, depending on, you know, the culture. So that's basically how they interplay with, you know, pregnancy and women going through childbirth.
Okay. And so why are they important? Why are they important? Why, I mean, why not? If somebody said to you, why would I want a doula? Why would I want a midwife? Why can't I just go to the hospital and just have my baby? Why would you advocate for a doula or a midwife? What difference does it make? Particularly because I want a doctor.
Right. Well, there are a couple of reasons. And just my professional and, well, let's just say first my personal opinion. I think it's more personal. It's a more personal experience dealing with a doula and a midwife. You not necessarily more in command, because it's kind of like the way that healthcare is made. When you go into a hospital, there's a certain time, unfortunately. And if you're taking too long, then they're going to use medicine to speed the process up, because this is a time and issue. Time is money. And, you know, it may not be as personal, as a personal experience. And there's a lot of things that go on. I mean, as far as the way that the babies, women, depending on the doctor, but most of the time, the gynecologist, the women are laying flat on their backs. And I don't know if anyone has ever had a child or have witnessed childbirth. That is like one of the most unnatural positions, but it's not even negotiable. When you go into the hospital, this is what it is. Your feet are placed in stirrups and you're on your back. And there's been, especially lately, a lot of research coming out, not only research, but a lot of lawsuits. There are things that are happening to women unnecessarily because it's a time issue. It's kind of like women are being just kind of brainwashed to think, like, I've heard women talk about, oh, no, I've already scheduled my birth. I'm going to go in, depending on where you're at, especially in the West Coast, women have their babies and then have a tummy tuck, a C-section and tummy tuck. Like, it's like a total disconnect from the whole birthing process.
Let me ask you this, Ikioma. How are positions of doulas and midwives important in our African identity?
I think, number one, it's very much a strong connection. This is pretty much traditionally, not just, in our culture, but women all over the world. This is our part of how we took care of ourselves. I mean, this is how we bring life into this earth, and it's a very strong connection. It's a very powerful movement to be able to bring a life through onto this earth. It's a process. And it's very empowering. It's very empowering for women, to be able to have that, make that decision, but also be able to go through that process. I'm not saying that emergencies can't happen. Emergencies have been happening for years. I think the big misconception is that women feel like, well, if I'm in the hospital, I'm automatically going to be safer. No, I don't work in labor and delivery, or what we call L&D, but I talk to a lot of L&D nurses. I've been on the floor. Women die in childbirth all the time. And actually this country has a higher percentage of death during childbirth than a lot of third world countries. But I'm not saying that it's because of the hospital's fault, not necessarily. That's not what I'm saying, but what I'm saying is this has been going on since the beginning of humans. Sometimes women do die during childbirth. And there are some unforeseen things that happen and, not happen. Just because you have a C-section doesn't mean your life is saved. I've heard a lot of women tell me the same thing. They give these women the same reasons. Oh, well, they had to do a C-section because the cord was being tied around the baby's neck. But I've speaking to midwives, they're like, oh, there's a simple technique to do that. I don't necessarily think everybody's baby has the cord around their neck, but honestly, it sounds like this is an excuse to let's hurry up the process so we can get on.
That's a critical piece that you named. I did not know that. And you mentioned in your statement about having a doula, having a midwife. Particularly, it's been evident and kind of rooted in our African identity as empowering. And that word empowerment is a very powerful word. And so I want to go back to Karen. And because one of the things that you mentioned, Karen, when you talked about enslaved women and how they use cottonwood bark as an abortive, and you said something, I always forget that last term you say, but I'm going to say as a contraceptive, right? No, not as a contraceptive, I'm wrong. As an abortive technique is what I'm going to say. You use some other fancy word that I can't remember. Having said that, we're closing in like the last 10 minutes of the show, and I wanted to get to some things in terms of human rights and lessons we can take from enslaved women on how to strengthen our acts of resistance, particularly in reproductive justice movements today. What can we pull from them?
Absolutely. I think it is taking responsibility for our bodies, like literally our physical body, our mental body, our spiritual body, like our emotional body. I did a lecture not too long ago, and I just did a survey of the audience, and it was like, how many of you all have or know someone who has uterine fibroids? So many hands went up. How many of you all, you know, have or know someone that has breast cancer, hysterectomies? The numbers are scary. And I think that is where my role, again, as an herbalist, is to educate and equip clients with information so that they can make informed decisions about their bodies.
Well, let me ask you this, Karen. That sounds really good, and I think it's really empowering. Question is this. First of all, you named some health issues that are scary to people. Breast cancer, uterine fibroids, because they can do major damage, you know, in terms of your ability to procreate, or give birth, excuse me. We are in a culture where in the Western world, we are trained to believe everything doctors say, the way systems are set up. We don't challenge those authorities. When you talk about taking responsibility for our body, how do we begin to dismantle that wall that makes us feel like we can't challenge people in those authority positions who have expertise in that particular area? How do we begin to do that in order to be empowered to show forms of resistance that support our reproductive justice issues?
Sure. I think, you know, there's a lot of fear. I mean, even historically looking at, just people of color, Black people, fear and doctors. You know, so Tuskegee, Henrietta Lacks, you know, all these heavy hitter, you know, experiments or taking things from us without our permission. I think it's so important to pause and to be okay with, okay, this is a diagnosis, and to know that you can get a second opinion. You're in the driver's seat. You don't have to go along with every single thing that the doctor says. You're in the driver's seat. Mm-hmm. You have the right to choose. And even with the number of hysterectomies, like I looked that up the other day, like over 400,000 hysterectomies a year, and they say 1 in 5 aren't necessary.
One in five of 400,000, that's 80,000 unnecessary hysterectomies, and that's scary. So I don't know what the conversation looks like. I'm just making this up. What does that conversation look like? Oh gosh, fibroids. It's just so easy to just cut things out and cut them off and remove them. But it's not really doing the work. Like, what was the underlying issue or concern that allowed these fibroids to grow? And okay, so not only that, what about the genetic memory piece? You know, we're talking about all this trauma. We're descendants of, you know, like slaves. Some of us, you know, descendants of slaves. We were in our grandmothers when our mothers were in our grandmother. You know, when our grandmothers were pregnant with our mothers, we were energetically, we were an egg in there. So how can we not talk about, you know, or at least consider genetic memory and trauma and that being passed down?
Okay. And so I want to ask Stephanie, I want you to tell our listeners what we can do as activists to ensure that Afro-descendant cultural contributions are shared and included in educational curricula and professional and cultural spaces globally. Because you did mention that, how you felt when you were sitting, you know, in graduate school for herbal medicine. Tell us what we can do as activists.
Okay. So what I've started to implement in my practice is pouring libation to my ancestors. Because if it were not for them, I wouldn't be in the position where I could pour libation for them, sharing this traditional information with people about herbal medicine. So we would go on walks, and before we go out, we call in the ancestors. I'd ask everybody to do that. I think another way, what we could do is if you have stories from people in your family, your elders, about herbalism, do your best to collect them and do your best to forward that information on, to pass that information down, so that you are making sure that that oral tradition is still alive and that that information survives. I didn't have the luxury of getting that from my ancestors. One of the things I'm met with when people say, oh, what's a clinical herbalist, or how did you get into herbs? I'm met with, you know, this kind of questioning and I often tell people, well, you know, I couldn't learn from my grandmother. She didn't have that information to pass down to me, so I had to go back and get it the way that I knew I could do that. And that, unfortunately or fortunately, was through schooling. So passing that information along to the next generation and to your grandchildren, so that they may not remember everything, but at least the memory of it will be there. And I wanted to say, I didn't get to finish like about the whole journey, but it wasn't until we got like deep south, further south and into Belize. And because I think timing had a lot to do with why we weren't able to collect a whole lot of information, but I got to sit with a traditional Garifuna healer. And it was in Belize that I saw how herbalism, how Black people in Central America still practice herbalism to this day. Like, it's not, because there's not modern conveniences, they still have to rely on herbs for home remedies. The clinics aren't as up to date or well infrastructured as they are in other parts of the, you know, in parts of North America and you know, further north. And a lot of that still incorporates spirituality. Our practices were not, herbal medicine wasn't separated from the spiritual component. We brought in our ancestors. That was a part of who we were. So it was great to see that that's still in how we practice herbalism, even, you know, that far down.
Okay, so I want to we only have about 4 minutes left in the show. So I wanted to ask Ikioma a question, and then I want to give each of you, I want to ask you a quick question. I want you to answer in 30 seconds, but you have a couple of minutes, Ikiom, to answer this question. We've heard from Stephanie on what she feels that we can do as activists to include Afro-descendant cultural contributions in different spaces. I want to know from you concretely, what do you think we can do, particularly in these traditional school settings? What can we do to ensure that as activists, Afro-descendant cultural contributions are included in alternative medicinal spaces, not only through the teaching curricula, but also in practice?
You know, there's a very thin line. I could say what I wish. Well, first and foremost, I would say that a lot of, because of restrictions and licenses and things, there's a lot of restrictions of things that we can technically teach, or our license would be compromised. So that's issue number one. As far as activists and us taking it in our own hands, I feel like we should create these environments where we can teach each other more traditional, that we can't rely on the larger infrastructure to include, mm-hmm. you know, us. We have to take it in our own hands to have our own educational infrastructures where we can teach our own cultures and have these candid discussions that would probably compromise, you know, some of our licenses if we were discussing more mainstream, unfortunately.
Okay. So I'm going to cut you off, Ikiom, because we only have 2 minutes left. And so I'm going to give each of you the opportunity for a closing comment that you would like to share with the audience before we end the show. So what is the closing thought that you want to say, Karen, about women descendants of Africans and slaves in the U.S., healers, culture bearers, and women of resistance? You got 10 seconds.
I just want to say herbalism is a global phenomenon, and I affirm and commit myself to teaching more and getting myself out there and supporting various healers of color all across the country.
Okay, and Stephanie?
I'd just like to encourage people to, if you don't see what you're looking for, if you don't see yourself as a Black woman or a Black male in the narrative of herbal medicine, go out and find it. There is information out there. There are people gathering this information to share, connect with folks like myself, like Karen, like Ikiyama. Reach out to us, and we can give you more information.
I gotta cut you off, Ikiyama. Ikiyama?
Yes, I was just going to say to encourage everybody to, you know, pretty much piggyback, to take your health into your, you know, your own hands. Take it very seriously. And, you know, question everything. Do your own research. And first and foremost, go within. Because you know when there's something wrong with you, and you know when there's something not wrong with you.
Okay, well, we want to thank our guests tonight. We want to thank Karen Culpepper, Stephanie McKee, Rochelle Ikioma Walker, for being great panelists tonight on the show, Women Descendants of Africans Enslaved in the U.S., Healers, Culture Bearers, and Women of Resistance. We want to thank the Race Treaty staff, the creator of the show, Robin Jerome Benton, Scotty Reed, the producer, and Onaji Muid for allowing us to have this critical conversation tonight. Again, this is Stephanie Franklin thanking you for joining us tonight, and we hope that you have a wonderful evening. Be blessed.
All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. all things ain't what they used to be. No, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy, mercy. All things ain't what they used to be. God's mind, radiation underground.